You know about the Murtaugh murders, a wealthy mother and son shot to death at their hunting cabin in South Carolina. By now, the whole world knows about the Murtaugh murders and the Murtaughs as well. But there is another Lowcountry killing you may not know about. A young man, not from a privileged and powerful family. And tonight, those two cases are converging. It is our story of the hour on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. Sandy Smith says she waited for 2,174 days for the news that she got last night from the South Carolina State Police. After all that time, almost 6 years, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, known as SLED, will investigate the death of the man in that picture, Sandy Smith's son, Stephen. Stephen was 19 years old. He was from the Lowcountry, the town of Hampton, when he was found dead on a country road in the early morning hours of July 8th, 2015. Stephen's injuries were nothing short of horrible. His case was handled mainly by the Highway Patrol and a state pathologist. Pathologist who called it a hit and run. Even though there was little to no evidence to support that, and quite a bit of evidence to rebut it. And for 2,000 days, give or take, that officially was that. Unlike their Lowcountry neighbors, the Murtaughs, the Smith family does not dominate the 14th Circuit legal system, does not make headlines with their every move. They are not rich. But there are some connections between the cases, both real and rumored. I want to talk about the real. And for that, I welcome investigative reporter Andrew Davis from WSAV-TV in Savannah. And with us as well, forensic scientist Larry Kublinski from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Welcome to the both of you. Andrew, I want to begin with you with some of the more disturbing reporting that we are learning from Sandy Smith, who has spoken extensively with News Nation about what she knows regarding the death of her 19-year-old son 6 years ago. I want to start with what the FBI said to her regarding some of the evidence in the case, more specifically, Stephen's cell phone, because Stephen's cell phone could hold a lot of clues as to why he was found in the middle of the road. What do we know from Sandy Smith about Stephen's cell phone and the FBI?
Well, according to what Sandy has told News Nation out here, the FBI agent Tiffany Baker had information, and she said there was information in that cell phone that was important to be looked at. But then Baker went on to say that SLED would not let her get into that cell phone, would not let them find that cell phone and get into that information that was there. Also along those same lines, there was not a rape kit that was done that the FBI wanted to be done. There was also no gunshot residue test that was done as well. Tiffany Baker says in this case, the FBI was not allowed to do it by SLED, which would put a lot of interesting information out there that seems to have a lot of keys to this case that was left to the side on this one, Ashley.
So interesting to hear that the FBI made an offer to do a rape kit and a gunshot residue test on the body of Stephen Smith, but that overture was rebuked. It just defies logic. But what's more fascinating is that Sandy Smith, the mother of this dead teenager in the middle of the road, has been begging for justice for 6 years. She wanted someone to investigate. She wanted SLED to investigate. And they have not begun an investigation. SLED has not begun an investigation until yesterday. They showed up at her house. They now are looking into the death, the mysterious death of her son. And they are making connections because SLED, as I understand it, Andrew, has said that they are opening an investigation into Stephen's death because of the work they've done on the Murtaugh murders. That is very curious.
It was a very specific statement they made to me directly saying, yes, it was connected to what they have found through these Murtaugh murders. Now, once again, Sandy Smith's son, Stephen, has never been connected back to the Murdaughs, at least when it comes to this crime. We're also understanding, though, now through what Sandy Smith is telling News Nation, that actually Buster Murdaugh and Stephen were friends at one point in time. They played sports together. And then also that Alec, the older brother in this case, was the one to go ahead and coach them. So there is a connection between these two, even if they weren't in the same area. His twin sister, also Stevens at that time, talks about how his car battery wasn't work. He was very nervous, though, that same day that he ended up death. There's a real question also with how much connection there is to the Murdaugh family. Stevens' father, who has passed away since then, he was actually had a case that was a case that was involving a lawyer. And that lawyer was Randy Murdaugh, who was, of course, Alec Murdaugh's brother and son of Randolph Murdaugh here. So he was there also the day that Stephen dies at the scene. According to Sandy Smith, Randy Murdaugh was there too, which has to make you wonder, why was Randy Murdaugh at that scene? What is Sandy trying to tell us with that? And why didn't people look into that a little deeper?
It's really unbelievable the cross connections that there are between these two families, one very rich, one very poor. Sandy lives in a trailer. She raised six children. One of them died at 2 months. The other one, obviously, Stephen, dying at 19 years. Just tragedy upon tragedy. Her ex-husband died 3 months after the death of Stephen in the road that mysterious night. Let me pivot a little bit here, because actually, before I pivot, let's just put the connections to what you just said. Alec Murdaugh, who's lost his son and wife in this horrible double homicide, turns out he's the coach of his son, Buster, and Stephen Smith, the kid who died in the road 6 years ago. So there's that connection between the families. Apparently, Buster and Stephen, not only coached by Buster's dad, Alec, but also they have the same friends. They have many of the same friends. They are classmates, Buster and the now deceased young Stephen. Sandy Smith does not suggest for a minute she suspects Buster in this at all. She said he was a sweet kid. She did not have as many nice things to say about Paul Murdaugh, the murder victim here. She said he was mean, that he was, she said, spoiled, and she said he was difficult, but she said Buster, her son's friend, was not. Okay, so I want to read something specific. Go ahead, Andrew.
Just to understand, yeah, Buster is the older brother in this case. Paul is the younger brother. No one has ever said anything bad about Buster other than the fact of that it was his ID that Paul used that night to go ahead and get the alcohol there. Buster has been, everything that I've been told, actually a very good person. He's trying to keep his life together at any point in time. Paul is the only one that has been ever mentioned, even in a rumor fashion, to any of these things that have gone on and some of the issues within right there. And that's a question, actually, that we all have, which is, if Buster was the good one, where did Paul come in this play? And also, how much did Alec have to do with it all?
There's so many twists and turns. You're even referring to another crime and another death that is not necessarily resolved litigant-wise, and that is the death of Mallory Beach from the drunk boating incident 2 years ago, and there is also a connection there, Andrew. Amazingly, Sandy Smith told us that her son, Stephen Smith, was friendly with Mallory and that they shared a lot of friends together. So there is the now-deceased young 19-year-old who was killed when she was thrown from that boat, her body not found for a week. They searched that river. Paul was established to have been the driver in allegations and in a civil suit. He was charged with three felonies, including drunk boating and the death of Mallory. And he and his family, or he wasn't sued, but his family was sued in a wrongful death suit. So there is so much connection between Stephen Smith, who we're talking about now. That's Sandy Smith's now deceased young son, and Mallory, now deceased young Mallory, the connections to the Murdaughs. Okay, Andrew, work with me here. I'm just getting these documents and reading through them, so I'm going to do some live reporting with you on this. You're going to have to follow the bouncing ball, folks. This is tricky. So the South Carolina Highway Patrol has a division called MATE. It's an acronym that stands for Multidisciplinary Accident Investigation Team. Andrew, I know that you're from there, so you know that. So for our viewers, there'll be some acronyms that are confusing, but there was an incident report. I'm just going to show it on camera. I've got it all marked up. It's one from 1 month and one from another month. So in July, 6 years ago when Andrew died, the detective from the Highway Patrol, his name is Todd Proctor. he did the investigation on the ground, right? And he made some notes that show there's something fishy going on. He was not happy with the pathologist who looked at the body of Stephen Smith, not in the least. He was so confused by what the pathologist had determined to be a hit and run, because he said there was no evidence of that that he had determined, other than the young man was found actually in the road. So here's one thing I just want to say. This is what Todd said. I asked the pathologist why she stated that, and that's hit and run, in the report. And her answer was, because he was found in the road. She had no evidence other than that. So that's very uncomfortable. I'm going to read a little prose here. Detective Proctor says, I went down to the Medical University of South Carolina. That's where the pathologist worked. To meet with Dr. Erin Presnell. She is the pathologist that performed the autopsy on the victim in this case. And that's the reason why I went. It was due to a preliminary report where she'd stated that this was a hit and run. Sergeant Moore had already, from my understanding, had a heated conversation with Dr. Presnell about this issue. She went on to say how they normally have a very good working relationship, mate, you know, the accident patrol and the South Carolina, you know, medical division. But she said things got very uncomfortable. Andrew, she said the tone and demeanor of Dr. Presnell was, you shouldn't be here. You don't have an appointment. I don't have the authority to even speak with you. To which he replied, yes, I actually spoke with the coroner about this. And yes, you do have the authority. And I'm uncomfortable about you saying this was a hit and run. I investigated it, and I didn't see any evidence of that. He went on to say this. I'm going to read exactly. I explained to her that we had no evidence of this individual being struck by a vehicle. I asked her if someone with a baseball bat could have done that, and she stated no. When I probed further, saying, what about someone in a moving car with a bat? She stated, well, I guess it's possible. She then asked if we found a bat as evidence. I could see that this conversation was not going to yield any positive results. And as I was leaving, she stated that the report was preliminary and it's my job to figure out what it was that struck him and not hers. There's something else that's curious, Andrew. There was a deputy coroner. Again, the coroner did not agree with this pathologist. The highway patrol did not agree with this pathologist. The deputy coroner who was present at the autopsy went down to confront this pathologist about it, and then what do you know? She got fired. The deputy coroner, one deputy coroner, Kelly Green, was fired from the coroner's office because she also disagreed. I get it. Sometimes locals and state officials don't get along, but this sounds really out of the ordinary, is it?
Well, I think you're looking at a state versus local idea to it and how much play the locals had into that. But to hear that MUSC really had questions there, or the pathologists there were the ones that maybe had some of the issues, or had issues with the fact of they didn't seem to agree with what Mate was saying, because Mate investigates these things very deeply. They're on scene. They recreate it. They try to make sure everything's done. The other thing, when you look at the reports out here, you were looking at Stephen's body, and according to the reports, according to the reporting that News Nation's doing, is that his head was in the middle lane, and his knees were pushed up on this one, it said, and then he had defensive wounds to his knuckles. Now, that wouldn't make any sense if you were hit by a car, because you wouldn't get those defensive wounds necessarily. There were no direct injuries to his body, but he had a dislocated shoulder and a hole behind his right eye, which I think brought a lot of questions to Mate, to SCHP, the Highway Patrol of South Carolina, on what exactly a hit and run is versus some sort of beating that was going on out there. Also, according to the pathology report from the reporting that News Nation has done, that the body was left in the road at 9:30 a.m. At 1:30, pathologists started their work, and the body was still warm at that point. That'd be 4 hours afterwards. The body wouldn't be, it would have gone into some form of rigor mortis or at least cold by then, which brings up even more questions there too. Along those same lines, we were talking about that. The black Nike shirt that Stephen was wearing at the time was also tested in this case. And they found blue chips of paint on that, according to the reporting we're getting. The blue paint chips would match a dune buggy that was used by the Murdaughs. So there's a lot of questions that come in there when you just hear about where the body was, how that worked, and then exactly what may have been connected in some form to that, actually, according to the reporting that we're seeing right now.
Andrew, it's all really astounding information. This all coming to News Nation from Sandy Smith and Larry Kublinski. This is right up your alley. When we come back after the break, I need you to go through what Andrew just told us about the condition of the body, specifically the fact that his knees were bent in what looked like a push-up, the fact that his head was crushed, but the rest of his body was fine, except for the dislocated shoulder and defensive wounds on both of his knuckles, and then that hole behind his right eye, and no GSR test done, and no rape kit done. Larry Kublinski, I'm going to get you to break it down for us. Don't go anywhere. Andrew, I'm going to ask you a few more questions when we come back. Welcome back. I am still talking to Andrew Davis, who's an investigative reporter at WSAV-TV in Savannah, and also forensic scientist Larry Kublinski, who is professor emeritus of forensic science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Okay, Dr. Kublinski, you just heard a lot of information from Andrew regarding the condition of the body of Stephen Smith. There was a lot that didn't sound right to me about the pathologist saying that this is a hit and run, even though the only thing the pathologist knew was that the body was in the road. The highway patrolman said he was uncomfortable with that. And you heard about the condition of his body. Defensive wounds on his knuckle, a hole behind his right eye, a crushed skull, a dislocated shoulder, but no other injuries to the body. What does that tell you from your professional perspective?
Well, the cause of death seems to be blunt trauma to the head. Could this have been a gunshot? Could this have been a hit and run? I think that's what the controversy was from the outset. And different pathologists and medical examiners can disagree. You know, two people can look at the same thing and have a disagreement. But let me address a couple of things one at a time. The gunshot residue. You're not going to find gunshot residue if the muzzle of a gun was further than 4, 5, or 6 feet away. So gunshot residue, almost a red herring to talk about. It's not clear. Secondly, you know, you can have a hit and run, injure a body severely all throughout the body, and not just the head. It's a devastating thing because you've got tremendous kinetic energy in a rapidly moving vehicle, which is huge compared to a human being. So, you know, could it have been a hit and run? I suppose it could have been. Could it have been a gunshot? Well, possibly, but unlikely. So it's hard. Now, medical examiners, of course, do the autopsy, and they have all this information about the body. But what they don't have is external information. Now, this particular medical examiner heard that the body was in the road, and therefore she concluded, well, you've got all this trauma to the head, must have been a hit and run. Must have been a vehicle moving very rapidly. Maybe it was the window, the mirror, side view mirror, that struck him in the head. Is that a possibility? It's a possibility, but we really don't know. There are more questions here than answers. So there's a lot of information here, but yet, you know, we can't be sure about what happened to this person. Now,
so,
why the body...
Doctor, can I just interrupt you for 1 minute? Sure. Because you just mentioned something, and you and I have had a lot of conversations about how surrounding environment contributes to a medical examiner or a coroner or a pathologist and how they determine what happened to a dead person when there's a mystery. But I want to read you something from, again, Detective Todd Proctor. A month after he wrote those original notes I just read. He wrote this. The pathologist also states in the report that in light of historical information along with the autopsy, these conclusions were made. To what historical information she possessed, I am unaware. I attempted to speak with Dr. Presnell at an earlier date to go over information that had been discovered throughout the investigation, and that was ill-received. Doesn't it make no sense? If you are the pathologist and you've got some historical information, you are not sharing it with the investigator. You are not saying what that is as to why you come up with it's just a hit and run. I have nothing else other than a body in the road. You're in this business. There should be a lot of sharing of information when there's a mystery. Does that sound at all? Does it reach the sniff test?
It doesn't sound right to me. I mean, normally medical examiners and law enforcement get together and they come up with different kinds of information. And the medical examiner is supposed to put it together and come up with something that makes sense. But nothing makes sense here at all. The fact that there's a paint chip that they found on this blue Nike T-shirt that Stephen was wearing, you know, that's a piece of valuable information because law enforcement maintains a database or a collection of reference paints on all motor vehicles, you know, the make, the model, the year. And so if they look at this paint chip, they could actually tell what sort of vehicle that paint chip came from.
So Dr. Galinsky, let me give you a little more there. I can't tell you from the autopsy report about that paint chip. I can only tell you what Sandy Smith, the mother of this young dead teenager, says was said to her. She reported to News Nation that she was told the black Nike T-shirt was tested. She also told us that blue paint chips were found from either an industrial tool or a Toyota. Sandy Smith told us that she was told by investigators that the only people who would have made that color of paint and that type of paint was Toyota or an industrial tool. And then she said, she told us that the Murdochs had a dune buggy or something called a mule that was the same color. Whether that's her own observation or whether that's something investigators told her, I cannot tell you for sure, but Sandy Smith told us, and clearly she is on top of this. This is her son. She is desperate for an investigator to take this case, and now they are taking the case. Larry, can I ask you, the fact that the SLED division that's actually taking the case is not from the Low Country, it's from the Highlands, different division. That should speak volumes about what SLED wants to do. Excuse me, not the Highlands, it's from the Midlands. That should speak volumes about what SLED really wants to do, how they want to get to the bottom of this and not get mired in maybe local ugliness.
I think you're right. I think at this point, you know, you need to look at motive in the Murdoch cases. And motive seems to be, could be linked to revenge. It brings up all the other terrible cases that we've been talking about, other murders or deaths. It could be that they're looking for, you know, a suspect who or suspects who may have been seeking revenge for the loss of a loved one. We don't know. But that, any way you look at it, you need evidence to link this all together. You need something to associate a suspect with a crime scene or a victim. And that seems to be lacking right now, except for some interesting information that's there appears to be a linkage between the young people involved in this case. And that's what they're going to pursue, obviously. But it comes down to evidence to prove the point. Cell phones are very important because there's all kinds of information. Who Stephen spoke to? Was there a computer that has information about connections of his? You know, you never know where something that seems trivial turns out to be the connection that police are looking for.
Okay, so Dr. Kublinski, you're right. You're absolutely right. There is no detail too small. And to that end, when we come back after the break, I'm going to be joined by a couple of other experts in the field. Andrew's not going anywhere. He has continued reporting for us. But we're going to be joined by a famed former FBI profiler and a legal expert on this. And just so you know, a cell phone has been discovered, according to local reporting, on the side of the road that belonged to Maggie Murdoch. A cell phone that might yield clues. And Stephen Smith's mother, Sandy, says Stephen confided in her that he had a sexual relationship with someone from a prominent family. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Banfield. Tonight we are following an unexplained and unspeakable death from 2015 that is suddenly being talked about a lot. And it's all because of the Murdoch mystery in South Carolina. Continuing with Professor Emeritus of Forensic Science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and esteemed forensic scientist Larry Kublinski, as well as Andrew Davis, investigative reporter from WSAV-TV in Savannah. We're also joined now by trial lawyer and civil rights attorney Mark O'Mara, who has represented George Zimmerman in the past, and Candace DeLong, a former FBI profiler and host of Deadly Women and the deadly type, both on Investigation Discovery and Discovery Plus. Welcome to all of you. So one bit of reporting I think is really critical, Andrew, is the fact that they have now discovered a cell phone, and it is Maggie Murdoch's cell phone. The reporting has it that the cell phone of Paul Murdoch was found at the scene of the murders, but Maggie's cell phone was not. It was found several miles away on the road. What else do we know about that?
That's what we know right now, is that the distance of that, and that they just found that they found it the day after as well. So they did do the searching out that far. By finding Paul's there, you begin to understand, was Maggie's cell phone part of what's going on here, or what would be? I spoke to some law enforcement people who are outside of this area just to understand the influence that this family has, and also the difficulty of this case for a lot of them. He's a law enforcement person who does a lot of investigations just like this. I said, have you heard anything new? Have you been working on anything with this? And he said, no, I haven't heard anything. And I'm really happy I haven't, because I don't want to get involved. That's the influence that they have. So the fact that they're even saying right now, they found that someone's saying in the reporting from Local Island Packet, I believe, that they found the cell phone, is a big step forward to maybe understanding it a little bit more. Now, there was rain outside. There were issues there. So there's no question whether they could get fingerprints or some sort of contact tracing. And that'll be another debate somewhere, because the weather may have really affected that little piece of evidence, which could be a huge, huge thing.
All right. I'm glad you mentioned that as well. There's a couple of other nuggets from the Island Packet, the local reporting agency down there that discovered the findings of the cell phone, apparently from a source close to law enforcement. They said, told them that the cell phone was found, also told them that they don't know whether SLED could find any DNA or fingerprints on that cell phone. You also hit the nail on the head with the rain. It rained that night, and that's not just from the source. That's also from the police report. They put up a tent that night to protect the bodies from the elements. By the way, they also mentioned something else I didn't know, Andrew, and that was that Paul's body was lying on the ground more than 100 yards from the main house. We had said earlier that reporting had put the dog kennels about, was it a quarter mile, I think, from the main house, and that they were found at the dog kennel. So that would square. And also that some distance away from Paul was Maggie's body. So that's fascinating, just to know that he was found some distance away from his mother's body. Larry Kablinsky, just quickly to the cell phone finding, the DNA or fingerprints. Look, I know that DNA and rain are not good friends, but I also know that they're complete. I know they're not complete enemies. Is it possible, if there's touch DNA, if there are fingerprints on that phone, even if it was out of the elements overnight, because that's all it was, overnight in the rain, they still might be able to find something?
The simple answer is fingerprints, probably not. DNA, quite possible. We've done some research ourselves at John Jay on just that subject, whether you could retrieve DNA from a cell phone, and you can. It just depends on weathering and aging, things of that sort, but you should be able to get something off of that phone.
Okay. Let me ask you, Mark O'Mara, if you can weigh in on this. I can't even follow the number of people, and I'm just going to ask if we can switch to Mark O'Mara for a moment. Mark, I don't even know if we can figure out the number of people that law enforcement are going to have to call and investigate, and or get DNA samples, and or find out what their whereabouts were, or their phone records, or their email or texting records. The number of people who may have had motive to do something to harm the Murdochs. I haven't even told you that Sandy Smith also told us that there were connections between her family and the Murdoch's family through Randy Murdoch, the uncle, because he represented her husband. And there's other reporting that says Randy was there at the scene of her son's death. And there's other reporting from the Island Packet that says that the law firm that the Murdoch's were members of had sued big corporations, especially railroads, winning tens of millions of dollars for plaintiffs in the past. There's just no shortage of people who did not like them or who were afraid of them.
Yeah. So I feel like we're in chapter 3 of a 10 or 15 chapter book that's a sequel to, you know, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. We are just now setting out the characters you know, the people, we don't know if they're protagonist or antagonist, we're sort of getting some of the information. But as Ashley, you and I have talked about with many other cases, we are so at the beginning stages of all of this that we can come up with suggestions, ideas, speculation. But what we do know is SLED is now involved in the Smith death of several years ago. There's some connection there, because if SLED is talking about it and telling the mom that we're now going to be looking into it, there's a reason for that. Whatever they found at the Murdaugh double murder scene has somehow connected it. Whatever witness they talked about, probably more witnesses than forensic evidence, but you know, we know 10-15% of what they know. It's just going to be extraordinarily interesting to see how this develops, because you're right, there's a cast of dozens and dozens and dozens, and there's going to be some seedy underbelly that's going to show itself before all of these related investigations are complete.
I just don't like hearing the very beginnings of Stephen's investigation, that the pathologist was at odds with the investigators and with the coroner, and they were physically having a difficult time with her as well as verbally, and then refuting what she had in her reports, and one suggestion that she'll just go ahead and change it to whatever you want, if that's what you want. I mean, that is really uncomfortable stuff. But there's something else, and I want to bring in Candace DeLong on this, if I can. Candace, as an FBI profiler, I think this is going to stand out to you. Sandy Smith told us something very interesting and disturbing about what her son had shared with her before he died. She said that Stephen confided in her that he'd had a sexual relationship with a member of a prominent family. He did not say who the member was. She has her suspicions, but she has also said she does not believe that it was Buster, who was Stephen's classmate and friend and served on the same sports teams and was coached by Buster's dad. She does not believe it's Buster. She says Buster was delightful to her son and friendly and kind. But she did say that her son confided in her he'd had a sexual relationship with a member of a prominent family. As a profiler, what do you do with that?
Well, I can understand. I mean, the plot just keeps getting thicker and thicker. The fact that what you're now telling me, what Sandy was told by her son, and then going back to the beginning of the show where you talked about the FBI initially was involved in what was being called a hit and run, an accident where someone died on a road, and offered to do a rape kit. What in the world was that all about? I would love to know more about that. But now we come around to this new information, and if I can't imagine how difficult it would be for a teenage boy to tell his mother he's maybe telling her for the first time he's gay. Maybe he knew.
No, that he's not. I will say this, Candace. Apparently, he was quite open about his sexuality from a very early age. It was a point of contention with his dad, but later in his life, apparently, his dad was fine. They had a very close relationship. His dad actually ended up dying just 3 months after Stephen was found dead in the road. And Sandy says that her ex-husband, Joel, died of a broken heart because of what happened to her son, that they were very close and very loving. But I tell you, I mean, why you're not doing gunshot residue on a young victim in the middle of the road who's got a hole in his skull, a hole behind his right eye. According to Sandy, this was the medical examiner's findings that were shared with her. It's shocking. I'm going to go to break real quickly. When we come back, I've got a couple more questions, and there is yet another suspicious death. I'm going to ask our panel what they make of this, but apparently another 19-year-old kid in college, a classmate of Paul Murdaugh, also dead. And Sandy has her suspicions about that. That's coming up after the break. Welcome back. We have several guests on this disturbing story out of South Carolina that just keeps getting more strange. Andrew Davis is an investigative reporter at WSAV-TV in Savannah. Forensic scientist Larry Koblinski and trial lawyer and civil rights attorney Mark O'Mara, who represented George Zimmerman, is with us. And Candace DeLong, former FBI profiler and host of Deadly Women and The Deadly Type, both on Investigation Discovery. So I've got the best minds to try to make hay of what on earth is happening in Lowcountry in South Carolina. But Andrew Davis, there is this additional reporting from Sandy Smith. She has told News Nation that there is something else that's curious about Paul Murdoch. And she says there is another strange death that's being investigated where Paul Murdoch went to school. Do you know anything about that? Is there any talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit. Sandy talked to News Nation about this, and my understanding is Paul goes to USC, to the University of South Carolina. He was allowed to go back there after Mallory Beach's death and go ahead there. Now there's a 19-year-old student that was actually beaten to death over there on campus in that area that was one of Paul's classmates. So there's a lot of suspicion now around that death as well, not connecting it necessarily back. No one's claiming that. But there is suspicion because there seems to be this cloud hanging over the family of everything that's gone on, whether it's Mallory Beach, whether it's now this double murder, and with Stephen Smith's death on top of it. Also, just coming in, another piece of information, the Island Packet just released it here locally, that the Murdaugh name was put in there 9 times in the South Carolina Highway Patrol notes during the investigation of Stephen Smith's death. So 9 times the Murdaugh name was mentioned, even though Paul or anyone else in the family was not at that point. Remember, these are counties that are very large in size, but they don't have that many people. So they're, the fact that a lot of these people would know each other, you said Mallory Beach knew Stephen Smith, also knew both all the Murdaughs in this case, would make a lot of sense because they really do know one another. And the fact that they were partying and the Murdaugh house was known as a party house, according to what Sandy was telling us earlier, that simply that matches with what they were saying about the Murdaugh family when it came to Mallory Beach's death, that maybe the kids were out at the house partying pre-coming on the boat and coming into downtown Buford. So it makes a lot of sense on some of the things that are matching in there. The question is now with this other death going on, this 19-year-old USC, it puts that cloud right back on top of Paul and the entire family as something else hanging over their head.
Let me just repeat what you just told us about this reporting coming out of the Island Packet. 9 times the Murdaugh family name was mentioned in the investigation notes in the death of 19-year-old Stephen Smith. I have that right, Andrew?
Yes, nine times, according to what the Island Packet is saying right now, that it was mentioned 9 times in there, but then they were never connected back. And the Murdaughs, in fact, made a statement right after that death that basically denied any involvement in any form whatsoever and that they weren't connected. But clearly, South Carolina Highway Patrol had some connection to the Murdaughs. They were mentioned 9 times in this report. I haven't got a chance to look at that report nor understand exactly what it means, but that's the headline of that, is that 9 times in one report is a lot when you're talking about someone who's not even a suspect.
We also know that Sandy Smith got a call from SLED saying, we need to call you and just, you know, we're investigating the murder of 2 people. And we believe there's, you know, there's this old connection between the death of your son. And clearly SLED had this information. That's why they called Sandy, and Sandy called it a slap in the face. You know, she confirmed that meeting and that conversation and that offense that she took to News Nation, that this was very upsetting to her to be considered, you know, part of the investigation of the murders of Maggie and Paul Murdoch, given the fact that there was some connection in the investigation of her son 6 years ago. So, you know, I have to ask you, Mark O'Mara, about that connection and the fact that still no major homicide investigation opened into Stephen's death. You just heard Andrew report 9 times the Murdaugh name came up in the preliminary investigation into Stephen's death. But for 6 years, Sandy has been alone in this story, begging for help, begging for SLED to open up an investigation, begging for someone to do something about the weirdness of her son's death, about the fact she can't even get his cell phone back, the fact that she says to us that evidence is missing and misplaced, and no one is confirming or denying that to her. And I should say as well, News Nation has reached out to all of these agencies, to the Murdaughs, to SLED, to the Highway Patrol, to the the solicitor's office, and we're getting a look, we're in a murder investigation. We can't talk. I understand that. But isn't this weird that nobody went on a deep dive into the death of Stephen Smith?
Everything is weird about the investigations, or lack of investigations, in all of these murders, from Stephen Smith to the boating accident. And now we finally seem to have some focus on the double murder of the Murdaughs. Yes, if I was representing Ms. Smith, this is outrageous that for 6 years she could do nothing, including getting back the phone. But I think they contacted her to say, look, we are now looking at it. Sled finally said, we're going to give you, quote, your day in court, right? We're going to look at this case and see what's going on. So I'm presuming Ms. Smith is quite glad that finally someone is going to do what should have been done 6 years ago. Interesting, how we look at this. I look at these cases sort of like, a spider web. They look and try almost like a fishnet. They put these knots together. Those knots may be witnesses or pieces of evidence. In a case like this, because there are three separate investigations, it's more like a three-dimensional spider web, if you will. We have to sort of, law enforcement is going to keep them separate until they're convinced that they connect. And when they do, we'll find out more about it.
I find it awful that the pathologist said that that boy's body left the road at 9:30 in the morning. The autopsy's done at 1:30 in the afternoon, and Stephen is, quote, warm to the touch. That is what Sandy was told by the pathologist, and she said that made no sense to her. When we come back after the break, I want to talk a little bit about Sandy, because that woman is alone in her effort to find justice for her son. And now she is not. Now there are no shortage of agents sniffing around into all of it. That story when we're back. Back with my panel now. Candace DeLong is an FBI profiler. This is a simple question and not a simple answer. Who are they looking for?
Well, one of the things that jumped up and bit me in the nose about the initial reports about Maggie and Paul's murder, two different, vastly different weapons were used, both shoulder weapons, both high power, but one a shotgun and one a rifle. I believe it is highly unlikely one person brought two different guns, used one, put it down, then used the other on the other victim. That makes no sense behaviorally at all. So I think there's probably more than one person involved. To your point, looking for more than one. But let me say this about, you touched on it earlier, the possible suspect pool is huge. Not only do we have, and Mr. O'Meara touched on the fact of revenge being a possible motivator, the three top motivators of any murder.
I got to wrap it there.
Yeah.
You know, Candace, I'm so sorry. I'm flat out of time, and I'm so sorry because there's so much more to discuss. I want to thank my panel, Andrew Davis and Larry Kablinsky. Thank you. Mark O'Meara, Candace DeLong, thank you as well. And then I just want to make this note to Sandy Smith, and I am sorry for everyone who ignored you. I am sorry the media ignored you. I am sorry that law enforcement ignored you. But hopefully you are going to get the justice you deserve after 6 years, and hopefully the killers who did what they did to Maggie and Paul will get the justice they deserved as well. I'm Ashley Banfield. Thanks for joining us tonight.